Julie DeCaro has just come to expect it. As a woman in sports journalism, when she reports on sexual assault or domestic violence by professional athletes, there's this immediate reaction. Or when she speaks out, which she often does, about harassment or gender equity in the sports industry, it always comes, this wave of nasty tweets. And nasty doesn't really do some of these justice. So she wrote a book about it, about what it's like to be a woman and to work or play in America's sports culture. We're talking about the book on the show today. But first, Amy Donaldson has her own stories to tell. She covered sports for years in Utah, high school sports, women's basketball, the Jazz, and she was good at it. She wrote these great, intimate features about the athletes and the coaches she covered, but you would think being good at it, being enterprising and dogged and thoughtful would make you, you know, one of the guys. But it never worked out that way.
I'd been a crime and corrections reporter for about 8 years, so I was used to being in an environment where the majority of people were male. But I think what I didn't anticipate when I switched from news to sports was all the little ways that isolation would get to me. I wasn't prepared for that. My first experience in the locker room was ordeal where they scream as I come in the door, fire in the hole, fire in the hole. And then somebody yells, a woman's in the locker room. And it was like people walk past, drop their towels, moon through the windows. You know, it was just the most surreal and humiliating. I didn't feel like a professional woman who had power and authority. I'm 30 years old and I feel like a little kid and I wanted to cry. Good journalism is not happening in most of these locker rooms. Harassment is happening in these locker rooms. Actually, I got harassed by high school students. I was interviewing a running back from a high school after they had a critical win, and some friends said to him, hey, what are you doing? Who is this? And he said, oh, she's trying to get my number. And I was so livid and offended that I told him, you know what, I'm good. I got what I need. And I interviewed another kid and I featured that kid instead. And I felt really petty about it. And I thought about it a lot afterwards. And I probably should have stopped in that moment and talked to that kid because he's 17 years old. But I just thought, I am not going to be degraded by a child. Like, this is too much. I was interviewing a Jazz player once who didn't even look at me the entire time I'm talking to him and shoot around. He never looked at me, looked at other reporters, answered other reporters' questions, did not even acknowledge me. Just those small little things like that, you're just asked to ignore. Just do your job. Just do your job. I'm trying to do my job. These things are making it difficult for me to do my job. People yelling at me, people catcalling me, people asking me, why don't I dress feminine? I can't even tell you the number of inappropriate questions I've been asked by people. And honestly, then I'm supposed to have this heart-to-heart, honest, or hard-hitting interview. And all I want to do is say, why are you such a jerk? But the breaking point for me was when I walked into the interview room after a women's basketball game, and one of my colleagues from a competing organization, who's a well-known guy and high profile, and also a man, and Mark Harlan, the new University of Utah athletic director, comes into the press room. I knew Mark because I had done the Deseret News huge welcome story, who is this guy? I investigated his background and talked to former colleagues and just did the big piece on him. And so he knew me and he didn't look at me, just looked straight at this competitor. And he walked over and he said, I can't tell you how glad I am to see you here. We really appreciate your coverage. We really appreciate the support. So great. These women are awesome. And they're talking about this team that I've been covering going to practices, going to games, and this person just showed up for this game, right? And they shake hands and they have this just friendly, you know, chat, like they're buddies. And he left without saying anything to me, without acknowledging that I was even in the room. That was it for me. I think I realized that I wasn't valuable. There isn't anything I can do. I am a woman. I am never going to be a part of the fraternity. And I'm just done being an outsider. I need to go do something that feels better to my soul. And that's why I left. I miss it. And I get messages from the coaches and the girls that I covered saying, nobody cares about us like you did. And it's terribly painful to have invested your blood, sweat, and tears into this profession, and it doesn't really want you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Julie DeCaro is joining us to talk about the book she's written, explaining what it's like, what it's still like for women trying to work in the country's sports culture. The book is called Sidelined, though she says it's a book about sports that's not really about sports.
I mean, my biggest fear when I wrote this book was that it's just going to wind up on the sports shelf next to like a biography of Mickey Mantle. And I said that several times. And so one of my friends took a picture of me or took a picture of the book on a shelf next to a biography of Mickey Mantle, which I was like, that's not really the point. But, you know, I think for Americans, and I can't really speak to other cultures, but I would suspect the same is true of Canada and of the UK. We tend to work through our issues as society through sports. So if we're talking about Jackie Robinson integrating baseball before America was integrated, Billie Jean King and the fight for first gender equality and then LGBTQ equality, Muhammad Ali bringing the Vietnam War to people's living rooms, the Black Lives Matter movement last summer, which was led largely by the WNBA. I think that, you know, the sports is a microcosm of our society, and we often deal with issues we're dealing with as society at large. We're dealing with those in sports as well. So I thought, you know, looking around and hearing from women in other industries, I just thought, God, you know, we have that in sports too. But because there are so few women in this industry, it's everything is sort of magnified, and it's, you know, it's sexism and misogyny on testosterone. So I thought that was, you know, this was sort of a good way to work through some of the issues.
So how do you describe your affection for sports? I mean, setting aside the issues that you explore in the book, which we'll get to, of course, the nastiness, the sexism, that sort of stuff. What was it about sports that really made you, you know, a fan?
I am a daughter of Title IX. I was born after Title IX was enacted. I grew up loving sports the same way my brothers, my dad did. You know, I played soccer, volleyball. I was a gymnast. I was a diver. I played softball. I played baseball. You know, I was always running around with the boys on our block playing 500 and playing, you know, all kinds of games at night, playing touch football and tackle football. So I think that, you know, for my generation of women and the ones that come after us, caring about sports is very natural, the same way that we look at it as being very natural for men, because that's the world we've been brought up in. I love the Chicago Cubs. Some of my earliest memories are sitting on my dad's lap watching the Bears and watching Walter Payton. So it's always been a huge part of my life and, you know, something that has always interested me. And, you know, I went through phases as a teenager where I was sort of obsessive about the Cubs or obsessive about the Bears. Sports was what I always wanted to do. It's always been a huge part of my life.
So you're excited to be in sports. It's something you've been dreaming about. How long did it take once you get the job for it to start getting ugly? And how did you react? Like at first, we'll talk about how you eventually started to react, because it's a really great story. But did it get ugly pretty quickly? Pretty fast.
It did. So, you know, when I was at WGN, that lasted for 10 months, I think, before they pulled the plug on the station. And I immediately went to another station in town, which is the number one sports station, and a bigger audience in terms of younger people, sports fans, just different demographic. And it was, you know, immediately people, you know, I would see it coming in on the text line, coming in on Twitter, people who complained about my voice. If I made a mistake, people were, you know, just all over me. This is why women shouldn't be talking about sports. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Get her out of there. Which then makes you nervous every time you talk. And then you start making more mistakes because you're nervous and upset. And then, you know, it was in 2015 when I was covering the sexual assault allegations against Patrick Kane that it really got ugly really fast. And one of the things that we're asked to do a lot in media these days is wear different hats because everyone is cutting so many people. So, you know, I would do updates for other shows where I was doing a straight news thing. I would also host shows, which is more akin to being a columnist, and I could give my opinion. I would report. I would write columns. I did all kinds of different things. And I think it was really confusing to people. I was trying to sort of walk this line of telling people how the criminal justice system often works for rape victims and also talking about, you know, what was happening with Patrick Kane. And so people, you know, if I said things like, you know, most rapists don't get caught or most rapists don't get prosecuted, people would immediately take that as she said, she called Patrick Kane a rapist. I mean, and it was really bad. And that's where it got to the point where, you know, I wound up staying home from work one day because someone took a picture of the small entrance that I used to go into my building every day.
Yeah.
And sent it to me on Twitter. And so I think I learned very quickly that this was not going to be an easy ride.
Well, go back to that moment that you say they sent you that picture of the entrance where you work. I mean, basically, I mean, that's a threat. I mean, you talk about the time that it made your blood run cold when you saw that picture.
And at the time, so just for a little context, because it doesn't sound all that threatening by itself, but I was getting constant threats from Blackhawk fans. You know, I hope that you get killed with a hockey puck. I hope someone rapes you with a hockey stick, you know, all that kind of thing, which, by the way, the Blackhawks could have ended in 5 seconds with just saying, please don't harass media members who are trying to do their jobs. Yeah. But they never said that. And so it was in the context of one day when I was just getting, you know, just tweet after tweet after tweet after tweet of people threatening me that someone sent this picture. And it is one of those weird moments. The only thing I can compare it to is in the moments after, if you've ever been in a car accident, where you're trying to figure out what just happened, what to do next. Like you have your phone, you know, you need to call someone, but you can't figure out who to call. It's kind of that play. Like I literally felt all the blood run out of my head. I could feel it going through my body. It did feel cold. And I just didn't know what to do. I've never been threatened like that before. And so you're thinking, you know, here's a person who either works in my building and has tabs on me all the time, or took the trouble to find out where I work, find out where I go into the building, go to my office and take this picture and send it to me as a veiled threat. So either way, I don't feel great about the situation.
Yeah. I want to say something, if you're comfortable, about the first paragraph of chapter 5 in the book. And this is a section where you go into exploring the online harassment that women in sports have to endure. And in this paragraph, you refer to this picture in black and white. Now, I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this moment. We can just allude to it. It's pretty vile. But it's the way you kick off this section. And if you feel comfortable, I wanted you to say something about it.
So I developed somewhat of a thick skin to getting the, you know, I'm going to come to Chicago and kill you. I'm going to come to Chicago and rape you again. Like, you know, all those kinds of things. But I had someone send me a picture in black and white that was of a naked woman who was bound, her hands behind her back, her feet were tied together, and she was laying across the laps of several men. She was naked. She had her throat slit, and they were draining her blood into a bucket. I don't know if it was real. It certainly looked real. I have it saved on my computer, and I haven't looked at it since, but I wanted to have it in case someone accused me of making it up. I mean, my hair is standing up on my arms right now just talking about it. It really was offensive. And I dreamed about it. I had nightmares. You know, I've talked about it and written about it now enough to the point where I think I've become somewhat desensitized to it, which is also upsetting. I don't want to be a person who can look at that and not feel anything. You do sort of get to this place where you just have this tough outer shell and you're just sort of numb. And I don't want to be that kind of person.
What kind of a book did you decide you wanted to write? Because part of this is personal. But there's also a really broad reach in here as well. Because you say in the book you wanted to take a holistic look at sports and how it treats women.
I really had to sort of be talked into putting a lot of my own experiences in there, which I think comes from years of Twitter trolls screaming at me, "You make everything about you."
Wow.
So I was sort of like, which is one of the really another really insidious thing about, you know, harassment is that you start to internalize some of this criticism, no matter how invalid. So, I don't know. I just wanted to say, you know, this has happened to me. I know it's happened to other women I work with. This is not okay. Nobody should have, whether we're talking about, you know, the way that we get treated in the office, whether we're talking about sexual harassment, whether we're talking about online harassment, the glass ceiling, whatever it is, it's not okay to treat us this way. And that was really sort of, I just wanted to sort of scream it from the mountaintops. Like, look at what's happening to us. Why don't you care? And I was really lucky in that so many other women agreed to jump on board and share their stories. And a lot of them hadn't shared those stories before. So I was grateful. And then I felt a lot of pressure that I wasn't writing this book just for myself. I was writing it for all of us. And so it's rewarding when women tell me, you know, that they can identify with a lot of it, because I wanted to do a good job, not just for myself, but for everyone who'd taken part in the book.
Julie DeCaro. She's a senior writer and editor at Deadspin. Her new book is Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream and all of our station's services. Catch up with local stories from KUER News and enjoy KUER podcasts like Radio West. You'll also find our uninterrupted streams of BBC World Service and classical music. The KUER mobile app is available for free on Apple and Android devices. Download it wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about what the world of sports is like if you're a woman, playing it, but also covering it as a journalist. The writer and reporter Julie DeCaro is with us talking about her book, Sidelined, which is really an expose about the toxic culture of sports media and how this is a microcosm for how women are often treated in the larger culture. Let's talk about the history of women covering professional sports, which you get into in the book. You say it's tough to say who the first woman was to actually get into a pro sports locker room, for example. But but women were trying to get access as far back as, I guess, the mid-70s is when they started trying, I guess.
Yeah, we think the first women who got in were at an NHL hockey game, I think in 1975.
Oh, wow.
I don't even remember the date and year. But it was an all-star game. Huh. And so there was really no one in charge. You know, it was just sort of this amalgamation. And think of what the NHL was like back in 1975. Yeah. I mean, certainly it's much more of a well-oiled machine these days. And, you know, somebody said, hey, are you going to let women in the locker room? And the two managers looked at each other and said, sure, I don't care. So they went into the locker room. There had been other women trying to get into MLB locker rooms with varying success, women trying to get into NBA locker rooms. But that really seems to be the moment when those two women went in during the NHL All-Star game that sort of changed, you know, started, the tide started turning. And it was a big moment.
Why is it, and you ask this question in the book, why is it that sports journalists have to interview athletes in locker rooms? Now, I had always sort of taken that for granted, but why is that even a thing? Because of course it is.
Yeah, I think the prevailing wisdom is that is when people are still emotional. That's when the players are saying things off the cuff without having, you know, PR people get to them and say, don't say this, don't say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially when I talk about Melissa Ludke covering the Yankees in the 70s, in the mid-70s, everything was taking place in the locker room was the story. It was Reggie Jackson versus Billy Martin. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, everything there was happening in the locker room. I think it is. I hate going into locker rooms. I think it is disgusting. They smell terrible. They are humid. There's guys walking around in various states of undress. Like, it's bizarre that our industry has sort of just decided this is normal. but that's where we are. So, you know, and a lot of the women back then were accused of just wanting to see naked men, which they still bristle at today. Because it was a really terrible allegation. They never decided to want to go into locker rooms. It's just that Major League Baseball decided that's where you interview people. So that's where they had to go to do their jobs.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that once women did make it into these locker rooms, that pro sports would push back. They didn't really make any efforts to control what was happening. And you write about, you know, what that meant for women in locker rooms. A lot of kind of ugly moments and disgusting stuff was happening.
Yes. There, you know, the, you know, Melissa Ludke was allowed into the locker rooms because a judge said she had to be allowed into the locker rooms. It wasn't, you know, a lot of front offices and players and coaches were not on board with this. So they, you know, were had guys, I know Jane Levy talks about them, guys pulling her onto their lap. You know, even today you hear stories about guys, you know, being intentionally very visibly naked in front of women. There, you know, someone had a bucket of cold water dumped over her head. Someone else had a guy, you know, one of the players send her a dead rat with a bunch of black roses. Women getting called names by players, women getting physically shoved out of the locker rooms by men. Just really, really bad behavior. And unfortunately, none of the four major pro sports leagues did anything to stop it. They just kind of let it go.
Let's talk about your voice. And how your voice and the voices of other women are just this issue in sports. And I guess in media in general, you write about trying to kind of work on your voice. You felt like you had to get rid of, you know, I need to get rid of my vocal fry, whatever that is, and the up talking and stuff like that. Talk a little bit about this part, the part of your voice that you had to pay so much attention to.
Well, so the minute that I was on air for the first time, there were men complaining about my voice. Yeah. And they would say things like, it wasn't that, you know, oh, she sounds like she's from the west side of Chicago or anything like that. It was, she sounds like my wife. She sounds like my ex-wife. I had guys say, I come to sports to get away from women. Why do I have to hear one on the radio? Yeah. Guys saying, you know, just, you know, you sound like you're nagging us every time you open your mouth. So and I really internalized that, and I really tried to work on it. I tried to, like, I talk in the book about trying to imitate Sigourney Weaver doing Planet when she was narrating Planet Earth because she was so great. You know, but unfortunately, it's hard to maintain that when you get excited, when you're being spontaneous. You know, if I'm reading a script, I can do a very good Sigourney Weaver impression. But when I'm, you know, talking about sports and I'm getting excited and I'm yelling and I'm, you know, arguing with someone and we're laughing, it's, you know, it's hard to sound like anything other than yourself. So the more I talked about that, the more other women started saying, oh, the God, they say the exact same thing about me. And I started realizing when Jessica Mendoza was on Sunday Night Baseball, I would see those tweets. When Doris Burke was calling a game, I would see those tweets. Always about our voices, always about sounding shrill. And, you know, none of us sound anything alike. I don't sound anything like Beth Mowins. Yeah. But what they don't like is that we sound like women. And we sound like women in a space where they don't believe women should be. So our voices are the things that they go after.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, you say what men were complaining about was something, as you put it, much more intractable than your voices. It was the fact that you, what, had entered their space. They didn't want you there. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely right. And, you know, for whatever reason, sports has sort of staked its claim as the last bastion of a place guys can go and be guys. And there is a very vocal minority to this day in sports media that just does not want women there. And it doesn't matter how good you are at your job. It doesn't matter what kind of access you have to players and information. And certainly if you have opinions on things that they disagree with, you know, they're going to come after you. And I think that we've sort of all slowly come to the realization that it's not about the way we sound. It's just about the fact that we're women.
There's this kind of formula that you identify in the book of national sports broadcasts. You've got, and this is sort of how it works, you've got a white man doing the play-by-play. You often have a black man doing the commentary. And then you have the women either back in the studio or in the sidelines. Let's talk a little bit about that, because you had to cover the Update studio gig for a while.
Yeah.
As for sideline reporting, and you do make it, we should say this, you do make it clear that there are women who are great at it. Andrew Kramer, Pam Oliver, you mentioned that. And you don't want to pass any judgment on, you know, one job over another. But you do mention how it's a limited position in the sense that, you know, you are only trusted to report facts. You're not there to give your opinion. Now, explain the distinction there, because I think that's important.
I think it is one of the ways that women are still really limited in sports media. So, you know, Laura Oakman is another one for Fox, for NFL and Fox, who is a terrific sideline reporter. That job is as difficult, I think, as any other job in sports. You know, Laura has told me she goes to all the same meetings as the guys in the booth do. She interviews all the players the same way they do. She puts in as much work as they do, and she's limited to, you know, 90-second sound bites four or five times throughout the course of the game. So, and it is one of those jobs where, again, you report what the men have said to you. You don't get to offer your own opinion. And I think that that is, along with, you know, being actually in the booth and doing analysis or play-by-play, are the places where women are really limited. And sideline reporter, again, being a really difficult job for people who have been doing it for 25 years, is the place where we throw a lot of young women into, which is, you know, absolutely unfair for someone who's new to sports media to be thrown into a role like that, because it is, you know, it takes experience and it takes knowing how to handle yourself and some maturity. So, you know, one of the things that all the women that I talked about, and I was lucky enough to have my own radio show where I could give my opinion, but so often we are limited to being beat reporters, to being sideline reporters, to being moderators. So you don't actually offer your own opinion. You just solicit opinions from all the men around you on your show. You know, and offering our opinions and having our opinions being viewed as valid as the men's, I think, is the real glass ceiling that we have yet to shatter.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book is just when this starts to not change altogether, but when women start to assert themselves a little bit more. You write about this class action lawsuit by a group of women in 1974 against the New York Times. Talk a little bit about how it starts to change to some degree, and what has changed and what hasn't, because the numbers, they're still pretty, they're not terribly impressive right now.
They're not. And especially if you take ESPN out of the mix, the numbers for diversity and, you know, and I'm saying all of this as a white woman, for Black women and other women of color, it is much worse. It's a situation where it might look like you turn on ESPN and you see a lot of women and you think, oh, there's women are breaking into sports. But when we're looking at newsrooms, when we're looking at radio stations, when we're looking at, you know, people who, whose opinions are solicited, there are very few women. We're still, you know, I would go to work and I was the only woman I saw the entire time I was at my job. I was the only woman on the air at the station, except for on Saturday when my co-host came in. So that's still the situation, unfortunately, for a lot of women. So it's, how is it changing? It's changing. The more we see women in that space, the more women are in the sports space in general, the more that's normalized, the better things get. So, for example, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, I think, has done a lot for normalizing women in the sports space. I think the WNBA has done an incredible job normalizing women, not only being in the sports space, but being in the sports space and speaking out on social issues. The more we have women in the space and the more women, every time you turn on TV, every time you turn on a game, you see a woman there, that's how it changes. And it comes in fits and starts, you know? I mean, it was Gail Sarans was on, you know, did an NFL game in 1987, something like that. And it was 35 years later that we finally got Beth Mowins doing the next one. But, you know, since then, we've had a lot of women, not a lot, but we've had many more women in the booth. We've got Katie Wingy doing Nuggets games. We've got Doris Burke. We've got Jessica Mendoza, you know, Jenny Kavnar and the Rockies. So it's not such a Kate Scott. How can I leave Kate Scott out? So, you know, it's one of those situations where we're getting to the point where I think people are more used to seeing it, but it's still the kind of thing where, you know, on International Women's Day, we're going to have an all-female booth That's great. But we want that not to be a once a year thing on International Women's Day. We want it to be something that happens regularly because that's just the way the schedule happened to shake out, you know, and we want that to be a normal thing. So I think that's how we move the needle and get things to change.
In one of the sections of the book, you write about domestic violence and sexual assault committed by athletes and how the media covers these stories. And I was kind of struck by just how complicated the basic economics are for covering a story like that. I mean, if you work for a media outlet that has a relationship with a pro sports team, It's really complicated. You say it can be part of the deal with the devil you make for working with the team. Talk a little bit about what you see when these stories come up.
But I think that, you know, for women, and not just for women, but for people who work in media in general, you know, I think there's two kinds. There's the kinds of people who feel the need to speak out and feel they can, and the kind of people who have decided, I'm just going to keep my head down and I'm going to talk about X's and O's. And the way that we're treated in the media is very different. You know, the minute that you start reporting on someone who's been accused, an athlete who's been accused of sexual assault or domestic violence, the fans just come out of the woodwork and try basically to shout you down and to silence you and to keep you from talking about it. You know, we've seen that with what's happening right now with Deshaun Watson. You know, one of his accusers has received death threats. You know, we saw it happen with the women who accused Derrick Rose. We saw it happen with the women who accused Ben Roethlisberger. It's a way of silencing women, and it's incredibly unfortunate because I think a lot of these people probably consider themselves feminist allies. But rape culture is rife in this country. It's very entrenched in the way that we look at women. I have been writing about what's happening at Northwestern and them choosing an athletic director who is a named defendant in a sexual assault or sexual harassment lawsuit. Excuse me. And, you know, I have had people emailing me all morning saying, well, what if she's lying? You know, these are really the only types of situations where we say, what if the victim is lying? We don't do that with robbery. We don't do that with, you know, someone's house was burgled. We don't do that with any other kind of crime. If someone walks up to you and punches you in the face on the street, we don't say, oh, well, was she lying? Did she make that up? I mean, we just sort of take it for granted that the victim is telling the truth. And we don't do that in cases involving athletes. And it's really frustrating to see.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you about the part in the book where you mention, and you thought about this, whether or not you should talk about this, the story of Kobe Bryant, who was, of course, accused of raping a hotel employee, and it gets complicated as you're, I guess, writing this, because, of course, he's tragically killed in a helicopter accident last year. And you had written this chapter where you discuss, you know, sexual violence by athletes, and you're thinking, should I remove this part about Kobe from the chapter? Would you take us through that, how you were thinking about what you thought you should do at that point?
I was sitting at the library literally writing the chapter on Kobe Bryant when I start seeing on Twitter, you know, that Kobe Bryant's been killed. And I was, I think, as shocked as everyone else. It was difficult to see. No one knew if it was real. We certainly didn't know early on that his daughter and that other people had been killed in this crash as well. I tweeted out something like, I don't know how to feel right now. And that, you know, that was a mistake. So many people calling my radio station and demand I be fired. And, you know, I said I was glad Kobe Bryant was dead. And which was it was completely untrue. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. So I could see the way that he was being memorialized. And I thought, you know, gosh, do I really want to bring this stuff up for someone who doesn't have the ability to answer for himself or doesn't have the ability to, you know, explain or refute or any of those things that you're concerned about in journalism? But I started having people reach out to me, women who work in sports media who were sexual assault victims, also some men who were very uncomfortable with the way his story was being covered. And I think it's a function of the fact that it happened before social media that so much of the sexual assault allegations have been sort of erased from history. I know someone who knows his victim. I was told that she is still having a really difficult time. And ultimately, I decided that, you know, it felt like the telling of his history was so one-sided And I absolutely appreciate and understand that he was more than those allegations, that he went on to do good things, that he meant a lot to a lot of people. But I don't think it's fair to buy into what his defense team was able to do to the victim in that case. And I felt like someone needed to speak for her. So I, you know, just recounted it as best I could. I was really worried about it coming out and how people would react to it. But I think having that year interlude between the time I wrote it and the time it came out seemed to calm the situation down a little bit. But, you know, early on, even tweeting about the fact that, you know, that there had been sexual assault allegations was enough to get you absolutely run off Twitter. And, you know, Felicia Somnus at Washington Post was suspended for tweeting about his sexual assault allegations. So it was a really sort of fraught time and one where I'm not sure that we were entirely fair to both sides.
So we talked a bit about your experience with these mass trolling episodes. And there's this public service announcement that you made. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. I'm guessing people have seen it. It's really powerful. And it's this simple concept. The idea is it's kind of like the mean tweet segment on Jimmy Kimmel. But then it just gets worse and worse. But talk a little bit about this, because you have to say something about the way people reacted to it.
Yeah. I had written a story for Sports Illustrated, for the Cauldron at Sports Illustrated, about what women in sports media put up with in with online harassment. And this would have been in the fall of 2015. And I you know, was continuing to go through it and getting it on a daily basis. And one day I got this email from someone I didn't know who said, you know, we're going to do this public service announcement. We want you to be part of it. And so I had had such a bad day that day with trolls. I was like, sure, fine, whatever, I'll do it. And so I go and we do this video and I sort of forgot about it after that. I didn't know, you know, if anything was really going to come of it. We thought maybe it'll make a difference to some people in the industry. The day that it came out, I was homesick from work. I took a nap and I woke up and I had something like 700 notifications on my phone. It was on it. My parents found out about it because it led off CBS Nightly News that night. That's where they saw it. And so it just sort of took the world by storm. And Sarah Spain and I, she was also in the video, we were literally doing interviews in the cab from one interview to another interview. It was crazy how much it took off. The thing that was so funny when we started talk, Sarah and I, you know, went to and run around and spoke about it. And we were talking when we were at Penn State University about how many people came up to us and asked us if the guys in the video were okay and wanted to know if we had apologized to the men in the video because they're so visibly upset. They're not the guys that send out these tweets, but they're also not the people who are on the receiving end of these tweets. All they have to do is read them. And they were very visibly emotional about it. They apologized. They apologized for men. One guy says, I feel like I have to go apologize to my mother. So, I mean, they were definitely affected by it. But, you know, Sarah and I were the ones that actually had these tweets sent to us.
Yeah.
And these weren't even the worst tweets. These were like the PG-13 tweets, because we thought if we put the really bad ones up here, YouTube is going to take this thing down and we're never going to be allowed, you know, no one's going to see it. So we had to pick like sort of the intermediate level tweets. And the thing that we sort of came to realize, and Sarah was talking about this on Twitter the other day, is that what really impacted people about that video was that they were watching men be upset. And so that upset them. And if it had just been Sarah and I talking about it and crying or whatever, like we're very used to seeing upset women in society. But when we see men upset, that's when people sit up and take notice.
You know, one of the things you do in the book that I thought was fascinating was you kind of explore the psychology of a troll. Because it does, you know, it does make you wonder, like, who are these guys? Who are these people who are doing this? What did you learn about you mentioned this Canadian study, for example, who mentioned that basically these trolls are, they exhibit the same kind of traits as narcissists and sadists and psychopaths.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that everyone who's gotten any kind of messages like that, just you just sort of sit there and stare at it and are like, who does this? Like, what is wrong with you that you will send something to a complete stranger telling them how you want them to die or telling them, here's what I'm going to do to you? It's just so crazy. And that's what I found out, that, you know, that a lot of these people, these are narcissists and bullies and psychopaths, people who, for whatever reason, aren't affected by this. And I think that, you know, adding the anonymity of social media to it is helps. And I also think that, you know, we're so used to watching people clap back at people on Twitter that you sit down and you fire off something at someone, and then I don't even think they think about it anymore. I've had guys send me absolutely vile things, and then when I call them out for it, they're like, I was just joking, or I was just bored and I just wanted to have some fun. Like, how is that fun? You know, threatening someone online with physical violence, that's fun for you? So the reason I put that in the book is because, you know, I was hoping that if any of the trolls did read it, that they maybe it would give them pause for a minute to say, wow, I'm exhibiting the same symptoms as narcissists and sociopaths and psychopaths. You know, I don't know. It's a very strange phenomenon. I don't know that it really has been studied the way that it should be. But I think it's something that increasingly we're going to have to grapple with as a society, because there are, and it's largely men, but there are women involved too. There's a generation coming up that you know, this is normal for them. Yeah. Well, if you don't want this to happen, then don't go on social media. That's their response to it. Rather than, you know, maybe if you don't like something someone says, you just move on, you know, and don't follow them and don't be around them and don't read what they have to say. But instead, they feel you're a fraud. You're a bad person. You deserve this. And I'm going to make sure the whole world knows, you know, the way that you really are. That's the way they see it. They see themselves as sort of like keeping you honest, which is a hell of a way to look at it.
Yeah. And people often say to you, Julie, just get off Twitter.
Yeah. Which is, it's impossible. For someone who works in sports media, I can't imagine how you could do your job without being on social media, Twitter especially, because that is where news breaks. There are athletes tweeting out things about themselves on Twitter that are news. There are teams breaking news on Twitter. You know, the way that media works today, whether it's sports or anything else, is the first thing that happens is the reporter runs and tweets it out, and then you write the story about it. It is absolutely where America gets its breaking news. And I think it's incredibly difficult to do your job without being in that space. And, you know, the other thing is that employers want you on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok. They want you to develop a following, and they want you to bring that following to whatever it is that you do, whether it's, you know, you're writing posts, you're writing in articles, or you're on a radio show or whatever. They want people, they want that audience to follow you. So developing an audience on social media is required by many employers.
So I don't want to give people the impression that the book is just dark and somber. Your writing is really funny. There's this kind of informality to it that's really nice. And it does, toward the end of the book, there are these moments that are just terrific. And I wanted to ask you about one trip that you write about to Pakistan, whereas you say in the book, what you saw kind of renewed your faith in the power of sports. At least in terms of women's voices and their influence. Talk about your trip to Pakistan.
I was taken to Pakistan by two wonderful organizations called, one called Women Win and another called Right to Play. And the idea of sport as development is one that initially began as a way to rehabilitate child soldiers. That, you know, you could take them out of this horrible situation they'd been in, get them to play again, to play like kids, and have that sort of work as therapy for them. And that concept has been taken and used in a lot of different contexts. And the one that I was involved in was teaching young girls in Pakistan, which, you know, if you look at the gender report cards for the world, for countries in the world, Pakistan is, I think, right above Yemen at the very bottom. So we went and we saw young girls playing soccer, playing cricket, involved in kickboxing. And it was such an incredible trip, because I think Pakistan in a lot of ways is what America would look like did we not have Title IX. There's no incentive. There's no requirement for them to include girls in sports. And so we traveled around. We went to Karachi, we went to Islamabad, and we visited a bunch of different organizations. And seeing these young girls who are willing to you know, they're playing in, especially in Karachi, they're playing in just ridiculous heat. A lot of them are playing in full coverings because they're not allowed to wear shorts or their parents don't want them to wear shorts. Some girls do wear shorts. But, you know, a lot of it depends on your family. And for example, the young girls playing at the soccer club, Karachi United, people used to throw garbage over the fence at them while they were playing. But what you see are young girls who are boisterous, who are willing to, you know, sort of have beef and talk smack to people on the field. Girls who are learning to interrupt and to stand up for themselves. And it was a really incredible, incredible trip. It sort of reminds you of, you know, the power that sports really has. We met girls who were 13, 14, 15 years old who had never jumped, who had never run, who had never chased a ball. And seeing just the sheer joy in their faces doing this and acting in ways that traditionally have been so looked down upon in their society for women to act was just, like I said, it renewed my faith in humanity. It renewed my faith in sport. It renewed my faith in the power of women to lift up women in other parts of the world. It was a really incredible trip. And I was just, a memory from it just came up on Facebook and I can't believe it was 3 years ago. It was a really incredible experience. I'll treasure it forever.
You write about the importance of solidarity, this kind of solidarity for women that And that's another thing I wanted to mention is throughout the book, there are these various solutions and fixes that you propose. And you mentioned how women should be supportive of other women, that there are sometimes, this was interesting, you talk about how because the resources can be so scarce, that sometimes women, rather than focusing on the problem of the system, they compete with each other. And you're just you write about the importance of solidarity. Say something about that.
I think that's something that is socialized into women at an early age to see other women as competition, whether it's, you know, someone has nicer clothes than you, someone has prettier hair, someone has the boyfriend you want. I think that that is something that society sort of instills in us very, very young. And when you work in sports media and you know, okay, there's going to be three people on this show, there's not going to be three women. There's not going to be two women. If you're lucky, there's going to be one woman. And so then you're looking at the other women around as competition, as your competition. And in that way, we wind up competing with each other instead of sort of all trying to lift each other up. And I think it's something that we're starting to turn the corner on. I think that it sort of all dawned on a lot of us simultaneously what was happening. And it's not just true of women in sports media. I think it has to do with women in media wanting to cover women's soccer and wanting to cover the WNBA. And, you know, maybe I cover MLB, but this is my friend and she's covering the Chicago Sky and I'm going to retweet and amplify her voice. That is something I think that has started pretty recently in women in media. And it's so important. I mean, because at the end of the day, when I am having a bad day because someone has trolled me or someone at work said something to me or, you know, and I'm feeling bad, it's been the women in this industry that have been the ones that have picked me up and brushed me off and pointed me back in the direction that I came and sort of given me a kick. And women don't get that from men in the same way they get it from other women. And I'm glad to see that I think we're finally all starting to turn that corner together and sort of lift as we climb. Because, you know, if there are enough room for all the white men we've seen in this space over the years, there's certainly room for all the women of all different races and you know, gender identities and everything else. There's room for all of us. The pie really is big enough for everyone. And, you know, normalizing women in the sports space is something that benefits all of us. So, you know, sometimes I'll put out a story and I'll suddenly see it's been retweeted by 10 other women in the industry who work for other outlets. Retweeting my stuff because it's important for us to raise each other's voices. So something I've really come to love about the way women in this industry are interacting.
Let me ask you finally, do you still love sports in the same way you did when you were a kid? That is, you know, do you follow, I don't know, the Cubs or the Bears or whatever team? Do you still sort of revel in their victories and the competition and the drama in the same way? I guess what I'm asking is, you know, has that experience ruined sports for you in some way?
I definitely don't feel the same way that I did when I was younger, even before I got into this industry. I think that you find out things about athletes, you find out things about organizations that sort of ruins it for you. I genuinely care and love sports when I think about its place in our conversation as a society. But yeah, I think I'd be lying if I said that I still feel the same way about the Chicago Cubs or the Chicago Blackhawks as I did before I started covering them. And I think that's true for a lot of people in media.
Julie DeCaro, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Julie DeCaro, she's a senior writer and editor at Deadspin, also co-host of the podcast The Ladies Room. Her book is Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.